Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, and I will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Alison Richard about the new book, The Sloth Lemur's Song, The History of Madagascar's Evolutions from the Deep Past to Uncertain Present. A moving account of Madagascar told by a researcher who has spent over 50 years investigating the mysteries of this remarkable island. Weaving together scientific evidence with Richard's own experiences and exploring the power of stories to shape our understanding of events, this book captures the magic as well as tensions that swirl around this island nation. Well, Alison, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So how are you? How was your week?
Busy. Busy, but it's been a glorious week of weather. I just got back from the UK to Connecticut, so I'm still sort of catching up on jet lag, and I'm about to leave for Belize. Anyway, never a dull moment. I often find myself saying, if this is retirement, just give me a job. Life would be simpler with a job. But anyway, it's interesting.
So can you tell us, what do you do?
Where to begin? So just sort of a brief account of my life. I grew up in the UK. I was born in Kent and raised there and went to school there and was an undergraduate at Cambridge University and did my PhD at London University and then was offered a job at Yale University in the United States. And in the feckless way of the young, I just sort of upped and offed in 1972, sort of not imagining that this would become my second home. Anyway, I was an assistant professor in the anthropology department at Yale and made my way up and became head of the department and then director of the Yale Peabody Museum and then provost. And then in 2003, just when I was thinking of getting my life back again, I was asked to become vice chancellor of Cambridge University. And after much thought, said yes. And my husband and I took off again for the UK and spent 7 years at Cambridge. And then we returned to the States in 2010 to sort of resume life here. But my husband died in 2013. This was not the plan, but you don't get to choose the plan. And so I've been sort of, you know, putting my life back together since then and engaged mostly on environmental fronts in a variety of ways, and also with the writing of this book. And sort of turning to the book and the threads that have gone into that, there are really three threads as I think back on it. And the first was is my research. I did my PhD on Propithecus ferroxy, the sipaka, the big white lemur of Madagascar. And I was drawn to that because a good way of understanding the rules, that the evolutionary rules underlying social organization, are to study rule breakers. And Madagascar is full of rule breakers. And in my case, what particularly interested me was that among most primates, monkeys and apes, I leave you to decide about humans, Males are larger than and socially dominant to females. But in most, not all, but most of the lemurs of Madagascar, including the animals I studied, females are the same size as males, and they are socially dominant to males. And so, you know, a question that sort of long interested me, though my interests have actually sort of moved on since then, is, you know, how are we to understand that? What evolutionary forces drove that configuration of social relationships between males and females? So my focused research on lemurs is clearly sort of a piece of what this book is about. But a second piece is that, you know, I was doing my PhD work in 1970-71, long ago. But even then, there was clearly a major environmental challenge facing Madagascar. Forests were disappearing. And it seemed to me that one could not, in good conscience, simply do research on animals and not roll up one's sleeves and try to help to ensure that there is a future for both people and animals in Madagascar in times to come. And that got me involved with colleagues at the University of Antananarivo and a village community in southwest Madagascar. And so since 1975, I've been deeply involved in grassroots, community-led conservation efforts, which look to ensure the future of the forests and the wildlife down in this area in the southwest, and the well-being, the increasing well-being of the people who live in that environment. So sort of that conservation sort of piece of my life is a second thread of this book. And then the third is my late husband. He was an archaeologist who did his PhD on early human settlement and its impact in Taiwan. But he decided to shift focus, and he moved his research to Madagascar and to the human settlement of Madagascar and how that played out. He opened he broadened my thinking and opened my horizons, both historically and just in terms of what I thought about. So, and in fact, this book, we originally planned to write this book together. And after he died, I sort of gave up thinking about it for a couple of years, and then decided that there was a book that I could write, which wouldn't be the same, but which would have sort of many of the same themes. Anyway, it meant that I had to do an enormous amount of work because there was a division of labor in the household. And I then had to learn in some depth all that he controlled in terms of paleoecology and archaeology and so on and so forth. So it has been a long journey to get to the book that came out this spring. Not least, I've always written for academic audiences whose interest one could assume. But this book is for general readers, and so whose interest you can't assume. And that's a very different way of thinking about writing and learning the craft of writing well for a broad audience has been a part of the challenge, but also the intense interest to me of writing this book, beyond the subject matter itself, about which, of course, I'm passionately interested.
Yeah, and we're very glad that you wrote this book. It's really amazing. So I was wondering, because you're a researcher, you're a scientist, and you do a lot of work in the field. So what draws you to working with the communities and being on the spot, basically?
So, as going back to sort of my earlier comment, first of all, I don't think of myself certainly as a primatologist, and in fact, at this point, I don't think of myself as a biological anthropologist. I think of myself as where I began, which is as an anthropologist. And anthropologists encompass. You know, being an anthropologist encompasses just about everything, is the reality. And seeing the urgency of the challenge. The idea that conservation can work just by putting boundaries around protected areas and ignoring the lives of the people who depended for their livelihoods on those protected areas, apart from the ethical questions, it's just not going to work as a practical matter. One has to, I believe, deeply enlist the support and engagement of people who live in these precious places around the world. And so, you know, that led me to become very involved with people in that community. And in a very real sense, they've become, you know, friends and neighbors. You know, it's been 50 years. And, you know, the mayor of the commune in southwest Madagascar, where I work, is now the grandson of the mayor, the young mayor with whom I was working in 1975. So, you know, it's been a long effort. And it takes a lot of time to build up trust. Because from the outset, we thought of it as a partnership, but actually there's a huge asymmetry between we from the University of Antananarivo and the foreign researchers involved. You know, we were sort of highly educated, quote unquote, rich, with access to power. And here you are with a community with high levels of illiteracy and no access to power. And so sort of establishing trust on both sides and a real working relationship, you can't do that overnight. So it's taken a long time, but it really works well now. It's, you know, as I say in a chapter of my book, the rolled up headlines about Madagascar are quite disastrous and depressing. And of course there is truth to them. I don't deny that. But if you look underneath those headlines, there are places on the ground where things work well. And you know, where I'm working in the Southwest with this community, things are going well there. And there are many other examples in Madagascar of local grassroots activities where nature and people are managing, are finding ways to live well together. The great challenge is how do we scale them up or scale them out? You know, that it doesn't solve everything. I mean, we know about global climate change. I mean, there is a need for action at every level, but the action cannot only be at very high levels. It must also, I believe, be on the ground. And that's what I've committed myself to. You know, the truth is, it's easy to despair you know, about the state of the world in all kinds of ways. But what I say to myself and say to others is, we don't know enough to know that it's hopeless, and therefore we have to keep working at it. And that's what I do. And maybe 50 years from now, all of these efforts will turn out to have been a waste of time, but I will be long dead by then and won't know about it. And I just feel that there is a moral duty, but also sort of a passionate interest and enjoyment and satisfaction in doing what I do.
So what would you say to our student listeners and early career researchers?
I would just say the meaning of hope. It's the epigraph of my book. Hope is the conviction that there is something worth working for. So go for it. And I'm you know, one of the things that makes me really happy is that 50 years ago, most of the young researchers were students from the global North and West doing PhDs and going on to academic careers or careers in the environmental arena. And that's essential and important and wonderful. But there were very few young Malagasy. Madagascar had recently emerged from 60 years of as a colony of France. And during that time, very few young Malagasy were trained as scientists and leaders of research and environmental action. that has been transformed. I was at a conference of the International Primatological Society in Madagascar, held in Madagascar, which is wonderful. It was the annual meeting. And I looked around the room, and I knew sort of the older Malagasy scientists, the few of them that there are. I know them well. They're old friends and colleagues. I knew a few of the young Malagasy scientists, but many of them I didn't know. And there were lots of them. And that is great. And more of the research that is being done today, and it is research that is essential for action. It underpins policy and action. More and more of that is being done by Malagasy. So that in itself is a really good thing. And in fact, my primary collaborator in Madagascar, I met him as a student in a field school that I used to teach in Madagascar in the 80s. And he was an outstanding student. And so we found a way to bring him to the University of Connecticut to do a master's degree. And he was an outstanding master's student. And so he went on to do a PhD at the University of Connecticut, returned to Madagascar, and is now a leader, an academic leader, but also an environmental leader in Madagascar in his 50s or maybe even 60, I don't know. But anyway, there are grounds for despair, but there are also grounds to believe that despair is not appropriate. And besides, despair is not an option, as far as I'm concerned.
It's great to hear. Okay, so let's dive into some of the nitty-gritties of your book. And can we start with the very basics? So could you give us the profile of Madagascar?
Well, Madagascar is, it floats in the West Indian Ocean, 400 kilometers or so off the east coast of Africa. There is a wonderful article by John DeWitt entitled "Heads It's a Continent, Tails It's an Island," and that actually speaks to the fact that although it is an island, it is in fact like a small continent. Its topography is complex. There is a mountain chain that runs along the eastern side length of the island, and the trade winds blow in off the Indian Ocean. And that creates rainforest in the east, and then an ecological and rainfall gradient that slopes off toward the west, and which ends up with a desert forest, essentially, in the south of the island. So there is a huge diversity of environments on the island, and that makes it continent-like in its diversity. So, and it's about 1,000 miles long and 350 miles at its widest point. The Tropic of Capricorn today runs through the southern tip of the island. So most of the island is within the tropics. And then there's just a small piece that is south of the tropics, as defined by the Tropic of Capricorn. The population, the human population of the island it continues to grow rapidly. When I began my research in 1970, the population was about 10 million. It's now up to 22 million, 25 million and counting. So there has been a rapid population expansion, but still, if you look at the land area, the population density is actually not that high. So it's not a crowded island still today. I don't know there's a lot more to say about the sort of the peopling of Madagascar, but maybe that comes later in this conversation.
So how was it formed initially?
Well, go back 250 million years, which I do in chapter two, and Madagascar was just a sort of an anonymous, inconsequential wedge of land in the middle of Gondwana, with sort of attached to Africa on the left and India on the right and Australia and Antarctica somewhere at the bottom and pieces of Northern Africa and Eurasia at the top. And it drifted south through time. There was a point at which Gondwana and Madagascar were over the South Pole. But about 125 million years ago, Gondwana began to break up. And the first thing that happened was that the Mozambique Channel, which separates Madagascar from Africa, opened up. Africa began drifting off to the west. And that is a very deep channel. And then by 88 million years ago, India started drifting off to the northeast for its great collision with Eurasia, which raised the Himalayas. And so by that point, the date of separation for Australia and Antarctica from Madagascar is still not well settled. But there's general consensus that by 88 million years ago, Madagascar was entirely surrounded by water far south of where it is today. And from 65 million years ago or so, Madagascar, in parallel with Africa, began drifting north. And for 30, 40 million years, Madagascar slowly made its way northward to reach its current position somewhere between 8 and 15 million years ago. As an interesting footnote, when Alfred Wegener was arguing the case for the reality of continental drift and for what we now call plate tectonics, there were two places in the world where he estimated the rate of movement of continents. And one of them was Greenland, and the other was Madagascar. It's an unsung starring role for Madagascar in the history of plate tectonics. Anyway, his estimate of the speed at which Madagascar was moving was way off. If Madagascar actually moved as fast as Wegener said, it would be on the other side of the world by now. And he did, in fact, in his last treatise in 1929, he quite cheerfully said, well, I may be off on the precise estimates, but I've got the general direction right. So sort of a major theme of my book is of Madagascar as a place of change. It is not the prevailing wisdom is of this sort of timeless tropical paradise covered with forest until people arrived and then they cut down or burned down the forest and slaughtered all the animals. So it's a story of no change followed by disaster. And a major theme and thread in my book is to say, no, Madagascar has always been a place of change and quite literally of movement across the face of the globe, but also movement in the sense of tectonic activity, which uplifted the mountain chain that we see today, which plunged part of the island under the sea for long periods of time. The southwest was covered by the sea 65 million years ago. And as it moved across the globe, the climate changed and the sea currents and the directionality of the sea currents changed. And all of that had implications for the vegetation cover of the island and for the animals that could reach the island and live there. So I should back up a little and say, when I set out to write this book, I set out primarily to debunk this notion of Madagascar as a timeless place destroyed by the arrival of the Malagasy people, which is based on flawed and incomplete evidence at best, and plain wrong evidence at worst. And yet it is still the prevailing story because it's a powerful story. It's the story of Paradise Lost, which has been part of Western history for 3,000 years. So I set out to debunk that story. But as I went along, I became sort of entranced by, captivated by, seduced by, I'm not sure what the word is, just by sort of the magic of this complex and rich history. And so the book sort of shifted toward becoming, an account of that history, but within a context of the power of storytelling and stories to shape the way we see the world, to shape the kinds of evidence we look for, and to shape the way that we interpret evidence. And you know, as a scientist, all of that interests me greatly, that empirical evidence is essential, of course, but it isn't quite as absolute as one would like to think. And this book has really brought that home to me. If you don't look for evidence for the existence of grasslands, it's very easy to just assume that there were none. But once you start looking for the evidence, as the botanists from the Missouri Botanical Gardens in particular, also from Kew in the UK, as they have shown, there is ample evidence of grasslands, C4 grasslands, stretching back, between 4 and 7 million years ago. So, it depends what you look for, depends how you interpret what you see, and how you view the world, for that matter.
So before we go to humans, can we just discuss a bit what kind of plants and animals were there in Madagascar? Were there any dinosaurs at all?
Oh, indeed. So going back to Gondwana time, the first fossil deposits are something which have been found in the west of the island by Luva Shua and John Flynn and their team. And they are a very, very strange creatures. They are not yet dinosaurs, early reptiles, pre-mammals, a landscape of creatures unlike any alive today, early Gondwana fauna. Then you fast forward to 68 million years ago, and David Krauss and his colleagues have found very rich fossil deposits in the northwest of the island. And what a world that was. There were vegetarian crocodiles. There were giant predatory frogs called Beelzebufo madagascariensis, is the giant predatory frog, otherwise known as the frog from hell. And seven species of dinosaurs, some of them flying. There were experiments in being birds, though none of their descendants are alive today. It was a rich and remarkable fauna. Dr. Seuss couldn't have made it up. I mean, it was just sort of bizarre and amazing. But then 66 million years ago, when the asteroid hit in the Gulf of Mexico and destroyed 75% or so of land animals globally, as best we can tell, everything in Madagascar was wiped out in what ensued, with two exceptions. There are two groups of animals alive today whose ancestors trace back before that boundary 66 million years ago. One are blind snakes, and the other are iguanas. There is a question mark over boa snakes. The molecular dating is not good enough. The resolution isn't good enough to be sure about that. But basically, everything that is alive in Madagascar today, according to the molecular evidence, arrived on the island, settled the island, when it was surrounded by deep water. I keep saying the molecular evidence because in a quirk of geological history, there are no fossil deposits from 66 million years ago until about 120,000 years ago at the maximum, when researchers have been finding subfossils, incompletely fossilized remains. So everything we know about the period when the wildlife that we see today evolved comes from reverse engineering using molecular techniques from wildlife alive today. That means that anything that arrived on the island but didn't survive to the present leaves no trace at all. So it's a very incomplete story. And there are paleontologists who are out there today looking for these still elusive, exposed strata of fossil-bearing rocks that would start to provide a record of that of those tens of millions of years, when for now the record is silent. So it was a parade of animals, and we can talk about the animals that made it over and how they made it over to give rise to the wildlife we see today. But a bit about the vegetation first. Well, you know, when Madagascar was over the South Pole, it would have been a place of whites and greys with not much vegetation at all. And when the pollen record begins, the earliest pollen samples are something over 200 million years ago. And then it would have been a humid subtropical forest, with the likes of ginkgo trees, gymnosperms, in fact. This is pre-angiosperm, pre-flowering plants. So there is that glimpse of a long-ago forested environment that translates today into extensive coal deposits in southwest Madagascar. That all went in one of the sort of periodic huge waves of extinction that have resonated globally, moving sort of, I don't know how long we want to talk about this, but moving closer to the present, as Madagascar, I said to you that Madagascar 65 million years ago was far south of where it is today. As it moved north, it entered and was completely engulfed by the arid belt that circles the globe around 30 degrees south, around the Tropic of Capricorn. And it is wide enough, deep enough, that Madagascar was completely inside that arid belt for tens of millions of years as it slowly moved north. During that time, the environment would have been very harsh, very dry, extremes of heat and cold, and it would have been, the molecular evidence suggested that the plant life then was this endemic, dominated by an endemic family of cactus-like plants, but they're not cactuses, called the Didieriaceae, which have spines and are drought resistant. We know there must have been pockets of more humid forest in crevices and protected areas on the island, because there are lizards that have survived to today that would not have tolerated the dry conditions that would have prevailed at those times. But Madagascar emerged from that belt and was well, largely north of the Tropic of Capricorn by about 30 million years ago. And then one starts to see, the spread of the vegetation that that would look far more like what we see today, with mainly dominated by angiosperms, lots of endemicity, and by these dry drought tolerant plants. And formations in the south, call it bush, call it spiny forest. It's a history of change and diversity, whether you look at animals or at plants. And for the grasslands, quite remarkably, what the Kew and others working on this researchers have found is that the molecular clocks suggest that the endemic grasses of Madagascar go back 4 to 7 million years, which exactly coincides with the time of the spread of C4 grasses globally. So grasslands of some description were opening up in Madagascar around that time. Interestingly, the diversity of endemic species of grasses, C4 grasses in Madagascar, is as high as that in the grasslands of Tanzania. This is not what people think, but this is what they have discovered. What did those grasslands look like? The current sort of model proposed by Steve Goodman is that they would have looked like Miombo woodlands, which characterize places in eastern southern Africa with a fair scattering of tree cover with grasses underneath the trees. Now, my own sort of argument is that they wouldn't have looked like just one thing. Grasslands change quite rapidly through time, and Ellie Eklofblom has done amazing research on the transformations within a century or two in southern Africa of grasslands into quite wooded environments and then back to grasslands again, depending on microclimate changes, fire regimes, and the interaction of those effects with the grazing and browsing community. So I sort of would imagine, my picture, I mean, there is so much more research to be done. This is, my book is partly sort of a call to sort of keep working and keep doing more to discover more of this history. But I would envisage a landscape where forests receded and expanded depending on environmental conditions. And there are pollen cores, or sediment cores, I should say, from the Central Highlands. This is the work of two French women, Gaston Van Campo and of David Burney, who've taken long cores from lakes in the Central Highlands, dating back 150,000 years in one case, but most of them date back 12,000 years. They're Holocene, essentially a record of what was going on in the Central Highlands over the last 12,000 years. Wow, I mean, 12,000 years ago, the Central Highlands were a coming out of the last glacial episode, were a chilly heathland. And then the heaths are slowly replaced by grasses. And then the grasses start to, the grass pollen rain starts to show evidence of trees, and there's more trees. And then there's a cold snap and the trees recede and the grasses expand again. It is just sort of, and then there are charcoal lenses of in these sediments with dense charcoal signaling a frequency of natural fire. So one can sort of envisage for the Central Highlands, where the record is most complete, for just the last 12,000 years, a very dynamic environment, a very dynamic environment.
So then coming to humans, how did they first arrive to the island and how did they impact the landscape and the local flora and fauna?
Well, the first evidence, and it is a faint trace, and it is contested, comes from cut marks on two bones of giant elephant birds. The dating of those bones is 10,000 years old. They're 10,000 years old. The dating, I think, there's no question about that. Whether the cut marks are made by crocodile teeth or human stone tools is contested. Knowing the people who've done the research, I'm put my hand up and say, this is evidence that this is a faint trace of people in Madagascar. It's the only trace that we have that goes back 10,000 years. There are a few more bones that date back 6,000 years, again, with cut marks on them. But the first uncontestable evidence of humans actually living on the island with an archaeological site was discovered, in fact, by my husband, Robert Diller, and his colleagues in Madagascar. And that is a rock shelter up on the northern tip of the island. And that dates to 4,000 years ago. There were people living there bringing quartz. It has a little microliths, tiny stone tools that they found there, made from quartz that they brought from maybe as far away as 120 kilometers away. There is evidence of animal bones, and in fact of two burned maxilla, the upper jaw of an extinct lemur. It's the only evidence in any human settlement site of people eating extinct lemurs. Quite remarkable. So anyway, so that's 4,000 years ago. Then 2,000 years ago on the West Coast, there's evidence of a little fishing camp there and again, another sort of occupied rock shelter. But the settlement becomes sort of more intense only from the 7th century in the Common Era. And at that point, you start to see small hamlets and villages all the way around the coast. By the 12th century, but not until the 12th century, there is evidence of people in the Central Highlands. And between the 12th and the 14th century, there is the evidence of the first, what you would call a major town or city on the northwest coast, which was undoubtedly a port for export and import. So that in a nutshell is sort of the evidence of human footprints on the land. Who were these people? Well, the earliest people to arrive were almost certainly people coming in small boats from the east coast of Africa, probably Bantu, maybe pre-Bantu. Again, that's argued about, but probably Bantu speakers. Whether they got to Madagascar on purpose or were blown there by accident, who knows? The Mozambique Channel is a treacherous channel, and sailing treacherous currents. The currents run fast south, directly south down the channel. And so getting across it in a small boat with a sail would have been a dangerous and uncertain undertaking. And so, you know, there's a sense in which Madagascar can be said to be sort of hidden in plain sight, because 400 kilometers is not very much, not very far. However, given the ocean currents, it's a very long way to make your way. But by the 7th century, people were coming from a quite different place. They were coming from Southeast Asia. How did they come? Well, the Indian Ocean was the center of a trading network for thousands of years. In fact, it was, if you will, it was kind of the center of the world for thousands of years, because the Atlantic Ocean has winds that only blow in one direction. They blow east across the Atlantic. So if you want to go back and forth, it's difficult. And nobody figured out how to do that until the 15th century. And then the Atlantic Ocean became a major sort of, you know, the lands around the Atlantic Ocean were joined in a major trading center. But until then, the Indian Ocean was where the action was. And there were traders going around the rim of the Indian Ocean all the way from Southeast Asia, you know, through southern China, around, you know, the tip of India, down the east coast of Africa, past Arabia, and eventually all the way to Madagascar. And presumably, some traders came and stayed. Maybe some traders brought emigres from Southeast Asia who stayed. But it is also highly likely that somewhere in the 7th or 8th century, people began coming directly across the Indian Ocean from Southeast Asia in bigger boats carried by the equatorial current that flows from east to west across the Indian Ocean. That journey was memorably undertaken in the 1980s to see if it was possible by a group of mad Englishmen and Frenchmen who set sail on a boat built along the same lines as boats would have been built in the 7th century. And sort of, you know, they navigated by the stars and they didn't have a single nail in this boat. It was all lashed together. They sailed all the way across the Indian Ocean successfully. They got within sight of Madagascar, and then the winds blew them north, and they ended up sort of very sort of unceremoniously in the Comoro Islands and had to be towed to Madagascar by the French Navy. Anyway, it was an ignominious end, but they arrived in triumph in Madagascar. But they proved that it was, you know, A, possible in principle, and B, very difficult in practice. But clearly, either directly across the Indian Ocean or around the Indian Ocean, people came in large numbers, because the genetic makeup of the Malagasy people today is 60% of African descent and 40% of Indonesian descent. So there is a major Indonesian component to the makeup of sort of the biology of people there today. And interestingly, women living in Madagascar today show a greater presence. The Indonesian sort of influence is more evident in women than it is in men, which suggests that who was coming was different, that it was families, men and women, who sailed to Madagascar to create a new life. Perhaps, you know, I think of them as the first boat people, you know, fleeing a very vicious and brutal empire that was being established in Malaya and Indonesia in the 7th century. And, you know, they were looking for somewhere safe, maybe. But coming from Africa, it would have been more just men coming. So there's that. But and if you look at the material culture and just the cultural ways in Madagascar today, it is a remarkable fusing of African and Indonesian culture. But one last piece on this that is truly sort of, you know, it just kind of wonderful to me, is that the Malagasy language is, and there is only one, there are a number of dialects, but they're all more or less mutually comprehensible. It's a single language on a very big island, and its closest relative is a language called Manyan. Manyan is spoken by people who live way upstream on a river in the center of Borneo, with no seafaring history at all that anybody knows of. So, you know, how did a language spoken in the interior of Borneo come to be the language of an entire island 7,000 miles across the Indian Ocean? It's one of the great sort of mysteries and geographical sort of miracles of the world. What is the answer to that question? Who knows? I mean, my own view is that trading has, if Madagascar was established sort of as the at the end of the trading routes, the Indian Ocean trading routes, it was it was a place to come to trade. It was a place to take, what did it take? It took the purest, best quartz in the world, up the east coast of Africa. So it exported quartz, it exported soapstone, it has wonderful soapstone, it exported silver and gold and other minerals, and who knows what else beside. In reverse, in my husband's, in this little rock shelter up on the far northern tip, by the 10th century, there is Chinese porcelain appearing in this rock shelter, and just sort of extraordinary. But if it's a trading place, if you're going to trade, it means you've got to go to markets and trade your goods to other people, and eventually those trade goods make their way to a port and are exported. If you're going to do business and trade, you need a language in common, because you have to be able to agree a price and bargain. And my guess is that the Malagasy language somehow, you know, in one of those kind of happenstances and contingencies of history, that the Malagasy language was initially sort of a lingua franca by which people bartered in marketplaces, and from there became the language of the island. We know that there were still a few Bantu speakers within historic times, but by the 18th century, the Malagasy language was the language of the island, and a very beautiful language it is. In another sort of interesting and sort of curious footnote, it wasn't written, Arabs wrote down the Malagasy language in the 14th century in Arabic script, but that didn't become widespread. It was eventually turned into a written language by missionaries from the London Missionary Society who came in the 18th century, and they wanted to make the language a written language so that they could translate the Bible and hand out the Bible to people. And the Malagasy queen, and they asked permission to do this, the Malagasy queen at the time, Queen Ranuvalana, and she said, yes, on condition that you use French vowels and English consonants to do this. So you can speak Malagasy if you know how to pronounce French vowels and English consonants. It was another sort of small intervention in Madagascar's very success, the state of Madagascar's very successful efforts to play off the British and French imperialists against one another, which they did successfully for 200 years until the French and the British went behind the backs of the Malagasy in the late 19th century and agreed that France would get Madagascar and the British would get Mauritius in a kind of dirty deal. And so France colonized Madagascar at the end of the 19th century. I'm looking at the time, and in all of this, I've not said much or anything about the history of the wildlife that we see today and the animals that have recently gone extinct. But maybe we've talked long enough, and maybe that's a reason. It's all in the book. It's all in the book.
Exactly. Our listeners will find out in the book. But I've got a question about the future of Madagascar and how the climate change is impacting it.
Well, as we know from the Glasgow conference, Madagascar was held up as a kind of poster child for the catastrophe of climate change and global warming because of the drought, the extreme drought in the south over the last few years, 3 years, there's now been extreme drought. But you know, you have to sort of temper what you the predictions, the simulation models looking forward all suggest and converge on downloading from the global data. They all indicate that southern Madagascar is going to get hotter and drier. For the central highlands, not necessarily so, but for the south certainly yes. That is incontestable, I think. However, just in the 50 years that I've been working in southern Madagascar, it is a region that is prone to drought. Every decade or so, there is extreme drought. And so is the drought that we're seeing now a consequence of global climate change, or is it simply an episodic, unpredictable period when conditions dry, driven by microclimate changes? There isn't an answer to that question, but I think it's fair to say that it's probably it's some of both. And that drought is going to become more common in the south. Whether it will be habitable for people 20, 30 years out, I think is sort of questionable. And what is happening now is that people in the current drought, they're moving north and they are moving into forests up the west coast. And they have no option. They have to feed their families. And so they're clearing forests to create fields, to plant maize, to be able to feed their families. So there is a kind of the environmental catastrophe is not only about malnutrition and suffering in the South itself, but there is sort of a different kind of environmental impact that is taking place up in the West. With respect to the wildlife, with my colleagues in Madagascar, we're very focused on where corridors of forest remain that will link these southern areas up into more northerly areas so that animals or some species have a chance to disperse northward, possibly temporarily. It's happened before. It happened 2,500 years ago in the Southwest. There was a dry spell and lots of animals disappeared, water preferring, animals that are not drought resistant. They moved north, but they didn't go extinct island wide. They moved. And so, part of the hope for the future is ensuring that there are enough natural connections between large blocks of forests and endemic grassland to allow much, if not all, of the wildlife to have a future. But it's hard. There's no question about it. And there's a chapter in my book, as you know, that talks about sort of the unfolding disasters. I'm no Pollyanna on this. As with so many places in the world, there's much to despair about. That's just the reality. But as I said, despair is not an option. So we won't.
And what discoveries in your journey to writing your book, The Sloth Lemur Song, surprised you the most?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't have an answer to that, I think. Because what I would say rather is it's been a marvelous journey. And if I have a problem now, it's kind of the book equivalent of postpartum depression, right? It was such a riveting experience. I was discovering so much that made me wonder and delighted me, and now my book is over, right? so there's this kind of question that okay, so now what? Now what am I going to do? What am I going to be when I grow up? That's the sort of question that I'm thinking about at the moment, and I have ideas. But for the immediate future, what I want is to do my best, and this conversation is part of that, is to do my best to ensure that this book reaches the widest possible audience. And that's not to promote myself. I've never been interested in that. That's just not what I kind of care about. And it's not sort of just to sell books. But it's because it's such an amazing place. It's such a magical place. And I believe that there are lessons to be learned. The book does have a message, and it is a message for me about the power of stories and of sharing our different stories with one another. Because if we're going to create a future, we have to learn to listen to each other's stories, listen to the different kinds of evidence that we all bring to the table. The evidence I bring to the table is scientific evidence, but that evidence is not accessible to most people living in Madagascar. But their evidence is the evidence of lived experience on the land. And that's just as important. And sort of finding common ground between what we Western scientists, Malagasy scientists know and understand, and what people living in rural areas know and understand, and their interpretations of the world, finding common ground between them. That is the platform, that's the springboard for a viable future. So I'd like to find readers for this book. I mean, there are the usual suspects. There are the people who already know about and care about Madagascar. And I hope and trust, and many of them are my friends, and I hope and trust that they will buy my book and read it. And many already are. But it's everybody else. It's everybody else that I would really love to engage. So, you know, so that's what I'm doing for now. And then I will decide what to do next, soon, but not today.
Madagascar your happy place?
Yes. And I will be there. I haven't been in Madagascar since the summer of 2019 because of COVID. And I'm experiencing severe withdrawal symptoms. I can't wait to go. It's like a second or third home to me. You know, the UK is my home. The US is my home. Madagascar is also my home and my family. You know, we have dear Malagasy friends there. And, and I love the place. And so it's just awful not to have been there. I've been in Madagascar every year since 1974 for weeks or months, except the years in which I was having children. So kind of not to be there for 2.5 years is really dire. So I have a plane ticket for the 5th of August, and I will be back there for a month, and I'm counting the days. That's something else that I'm doing at the moment.
I was wondering if you would also like to try the extinct lemur as a dish.
Oh, no, never. When I'm in Madagascar, what I eat is rice 3 times a day with the occasional chicken. Absolutely not.
Excellent. Well, this has been a truly fascinating and inspiring discussion. So you already said that you're going to Madagascar in August, hopefully. And what's your next project for the book, for example?
Well, talking about the book to anybody who will listen to me is sort of what I'm doing at the moment. You know, writing this book has been an anchor in my life, and I love it, the writing. And also, as I say, it's the first time I've written for a general reader, and I've really enjoyed doing that. It's a different kind of thing. So what might I write about next? Well, one of the things that I've sort of got caught up in recent years over there is working with women, and it's only women, who produce salt from the soil in southwest Madagascar. It's called Siratani, salt of the earth, and it is literally salt of the earth. It is a very strenuous and lengthy process to extract the salt from salty soils in the southwest, this part of Madagascar having been under the ocean for millions of years ago. Anyway, they do that and they sell it in local markets after huge amounts of labor for, 1 or 2 pennies a kilo. And so I have been working with them, looking for new markets for their salt. So you're talking to someone who has exported a half ton of Siratani to the United Kingdom, where it's being marketed by Steenberg Spices as a high-end sort of, gourmet salt. This happened just before COVID as a kind of first effort to find new markets and a better living for these women. At this point, I really question whether, using fossil fuels to ship a very heavy substance halfway around the world to market it in a place that has plenty of salt already, thank you very much, is actually a very good idea. But this salt, Siratani, it's interesting because it is low in sodium and high in potassium. So it is a healthful salt. And in Madagascar, MDs in the capital, doctors in the capital, actually prescribe it to people with hypertension. And there's a lot of hypertension in Madagascar because of its low sodium content. So maybe there is a market to be developed, a domestic market to be developed more fully and to plug these women into in Madagascar itself, or maybe, you know, people now put salt into chocolate. So maybe there's another niche for this salt. But anyway, it's a whole new adventure for me. If we can make this work, then maybe there is another book about Sirutani, and very interestingly to me, about what is the place for private enterprise, for private endeavors in the conservation arena. Because I have friends who say to me, good friends, in the conservation world, who say to me, no, conservation is about the public good. And what you're doing is just going to make, groups of women, the women form themselves into association. It's just going to make groups of women richer. And that's not what conservation is about. I don't agree. But I haven't articulated in my own mind fully why I don't agree and why I think there is a place in this broader community-based, community-led conservation action on the ground for, you know, working with women on Sirutani. I would love to think that there is sort of something that will come out of this at some point as a book. But I can't write a book about a failure. So I have to make this work. And besides, the women at the moment are quite pissed off at me, I gather, because I have not sort of, you know, I haven't been finding more further markets for them. I work on, needless to say, all of this is with my good friends and colleagues, Joali Suar at Sirasan and Jonan Ranivanasi at the University of Antananarivo, and with the whole community down in the Southwest. So it's not, this is not me alone. This is, it's a collective effort. But anyway, the pressure is on. So a piece of what I will be doing this summer, apart from just picking up the threads of shared lives with so many good friends, is sort of putting our heads together to think about next steps on this Sirutani project. We'll see. Who knows? It's all. I've never known what I was going to do next. Is the truth of the matter, Carolina? So, you know, I don't know. But anyway,
well, that sounds super exciting.
Well, we'll see.